Right now, we're here to talk about the future. And it seems to me to be really appropriate to come to London, to the UK, to do that. After all, it was 50 years ago that the US and indeed the rest of the world turned to London and to four young men for the future of popular music. And how ironic it is, or interesting it is, that today we can go down to the British Library, and not too far from the Magna Carta, you'll see the handwritten lyrics of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. So that was 50 years ago that the UK sort of led us to a future in the music business. Today, it seems to be a good place to go to learn about the future of publishing, just the future generally. If you come to London, as an American anyhow, with the expectations that you're going to find palaces and pubs and Georgian row houses and gorgeous little pocket parks, you'll find them. They're all here. In fact, they're right outside that door. But you will also find the largest, I should say the tallest, building in the EU. 87 stories, just down the road by the River Thames, the Shard. Quite a beautiful building, quite a remarkable building in the midst of all the other historic buildings. Not far away is another building called the Gherkin, which is, I believe, the second tallest building in the EU. And my only question is, since when did buildings get cute names? In the U.S., we have cute names for snowstorms and that kind of thing. Nemo and Hercules and so forth. But apparently here, the trend is to give your buildings cute names. So we're going to talk about the future. The future, said William Gibson, the science fiction author, is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. He also said that the problem with the future is you can't Google it. I tried to Google the future just yesterday morning. And on my Google, I found the result page, the first result page, was the bio for a rapper whose name was Future. And that helped me to learn everything from how many platinum albums he has, as well as to his what he pays in child support to his various former paramours. Another result was a program on the BBC called The Future. But unfortunately, The Future is not accessible from the UK. I thought that was pretty funny, because remember, he did say that, Gibson said, that the future was not evenly distributed. So at least in the case of that particular program, it's only distributed outside of the UK. And then finally, as a way to kind of set the stage for this discussion, I'll offer a caveat. The problem with predictions is they're very difficult, especially ones about the future. And Niels Bohr, the physicist, said that. So that's a remarkable thought. It wasn't Woody Allen kind of making a wisecrack. That was the very, I think, reflective physicist, Niels Bohr, who pointed out just how difficult this whole business is. So to help me out, we have a panel here of distinguished representatives from Threl Publishing. To my right is Jerry Grenier. Jerry, welcome.
Thank you.
Jerry is Senior Director of Publishing Technologies for the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, easier to say as IEEE. He leads a 46-person electronic publishing team responsible for technologies that are used to create and distribute content, including development and operation of IEEE Explore, a digital library that contains some 3.8 million journal articles. Prior to joining IEEE, Jerry was Director of Publishing Technologies at John Wiley & Sons. He's an active member of the scholarly publishing community, I think a familiar face and name to many of you here in the room. He serves on the boards of Crossref, of NISO, and the International STM Association, where he's currently the chair of STM's Future Lab Committee. The Future Lab is clearly why we've asked you here today. Then to Jerry's right is Ed Pence. Ed, welcome.
Thank you.
Ed became executive director of Crossref in 2004, when the organization was created as a not-for-profit member association of publishers to provide a cross-publisher reference linking service. He's also chair of the board of ORCID, a registry of unique identifiers for researchers established in 2010. He has a degree in English literature from Princeton University and he lives in Oxford, England, so at least there are two English degrees up here in the room, and I'm going to look to Ed to get me out of some difficulties around science and technology. And then finally, Roy Kaufman is my colleague at Cupright Clearance Center. Roy, welcome. Roy is Managing Director of New Ventures at CCC and is responsible for expanding our service capabilities as we move into new markets and services. Again, he's a face and a name familiar, I think, to many in the room. Prior to joining us, he served as Legal Director at Wiley Blackwell, John Wiley & Sons. He's a member of the STM Copyright Committee, as well as the UK's Gold Open Access Infrastructure Program. And he formerly chaired the legal working group of Crossref, which he helped to form, and has also worked on the launch of ORCID. So a great panel, and look forward to a discussion. We will move into the room for your questions and thoughts a little ways into the program, but I want to start with Jerry Grenier. And Jerry, we said you were the chair at the Future Labs of STM, so a good place to start. And just recently, you and that group worked on an effort to not so much predict the future, but to at least anticipate it. And you identified some important themes, and I want to talk about those. One of them was something that sort of helped to give the name to this discussion, which is that the machine is the new reader. And I like that phrase because it sounds futuristic. It sounds like there are robots and ray guns involved, right? but what does that mean, really, when we say that the machine is the new reader?
Well, let me start by saying thank you for bringing me here today, and then thank you for allowing me to share my thoughts. When you mentioned the Beatles at the beginning, I was hoping you could assign us names. I was wondering as you were talking, am I John, Paul, George, or Ringo? But anyway, it's great to be here.
What does it say about me that I always thought I was Ringo? I don't know why. I never thought I was the cute one. I never thought I was the smart aleck one or anything like that. I thought I was the dumb one, I guess.
Well, I always thought I was Pete Best, you know, the one who quit before they get big.
The one who lost out, yeah.
But anyway, but it's great to be here. And I see a member of the Future Lab, Sam Brinsma from Bill, is back there. And Sam sat in. So, Sam, you're my... You're my conscience here today, so if I go off on a tangent, just bring me back to reality. So what do we mean by the reader is a machine? First of all, the Futures Lab is a great forum and a great service that STM has put together. What we do is we gather technology, a mix of technology as well as publishing business people, to sit at least once a year in a round table, generally in London, at the day before our innovation seminar. And we go around the room three times and ask people what they see as the trends for the coming year. And then we boil that down. There's lots of redundancy, obviously. But then we, at the end of the afternoon, boil that down into themes. And this year's the most prominent theme was the machine is the new reader. And what do we mean by that? Well, I think we're seeing the dawn of the age of, or at least the maturation of this whole science of computational linguistics, right? It's a science that really began somewhere around the 70s and 80s and is now just getting us to a point, you know, and I think driven by the internet, where people really like to seek deeper meaning in the words, or actually like to see a machine do the thinking for them. So breaking down text into their parts of speech and then being able to discern you know, some thematics, you know, themes, and being able to fingerprint articles, I think is something that's, you know, we're bringing us one step further now, right? So that we don't need to spend time to actually read that article. We can have a machine actually summarize it for us and give us some insight into the deeper meaning of it.
So in essence, the article finds me.
Yeah, I think that was something that someone might have said on that Friday afternoon back in December. The article finds you, exactly.
Right. Which addresses one of the key challenges throughout all of publishing, not just in the STM environment, but throughout publishing, which is discovery and sort of getting. There's such a plethora of content available to people, so many choices, to be able to push material, to push information at the recipient and the appropriate one is really something to work hard for?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the combination of a machine doing some linguistic analysis of an article, but also a machine learning the habits of the user, right, and being able to define, you know, my interests by, you know, tracking the things that I read. Amazon does this on a very simple level with the products that we purchase and the products that we view online at Amazon. But it's that combination of, you know, matching those two things up. So what content set is out there, and what content set does Jerry like to read, and what has he read in the past, and try to bring those together. You know, at a better level, do a better job of that than we might have done, you know, in the early part of this century.
Well, you brought up Amazon, Jerry, and what's interesting about that, I think, is that the user today, we used to call them the reader, has an experience online that goes far beyond their work experience. It encompasses their personal lives, their consumer experience, and some of the expectations that are raised by companies like Amazon and Apple and Google sort of bleed back into their professional lives. And so it really sort of puts the burden on professional publishing to really come up to those expectations that have been set elsewhere on the internet.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no question that I think the one thing that you have probably all been part of your own customer. You know, we at IEEE have customer feedback panels and constantly touring the nation and the world, actually, and getting feedback from user groups. And what we hear all the time is, yeah, I want it to be like Amazon. I want it to be like Google. I want it to be like XYZ. And in some ways that's good because, you know, we have these companies, you know, pioneering and it's easy to follow in someone else's footsteps. But, you know, on the other hand, I think at least in science publishing, it presents some, you know, particular problems, especially in the area of article recommendation that a bit more complex than in simply, recommending, a different pair of shoes or recommending a particular appliance. When you think about the descriptive terms that are used to, in the consumer world, they're far more simple than, the concepts in a, 10,000 word journal article.
Well, absolutely. And I can't imagine, too, that you're going to be delivering your subscriptions by drones anytime soon.
No. No, I don't think so, but we're working on that.
Well, you work on that, too. So I want to bring Ed Pence into this because I think it makes a good transition from what Jerry was just saying about, helping identify materials and getting them to the right people is really all about shifting to a more responsive technology on behalf of the needs of the researchers, the authors, the people who are actually using the material. Can you talk about the ways that Crossref sees the future with regard to helping that particular objective, serving those needs, the authors and the researchers?
Yeah, I think looking at it from the point of view in authors and researchers and touching on what Jerry was saying about, the machine, I think Dominic had a really good comment about, Google hiding the complexity and making it easy. So I think that I would agree with Jerry that scholarly content is much more complicated and the discovery issues are more complicated. But I think that's one of the challenges for publishers is to make it as easy as it is to use Google. And actually, in fact, a lot of publishers see a lot of traffic from Google. So researchers are using it, and their use of consumer technology, is setting their expectations for how they use scholarly content. But having said that, I think it's really important for scholarly publishers to understand about the things that they do that are unique. How do publishers go about establishing, making sure content is high quality? Right. There's a whole set of things that publishers do that aren't apparent to readers of content. We have to move beyond. Right now, there's a lot of reliance on journal brands. right? That, okay, well, this this article's in Nature, this article's in Cell, and so people see that as conveying quality, and often it does. But there's so many different types of resources now. Researchers are publishing in many different formats. There's blog postings, that type of thing. So I think the real challenge for publishers is conveying better information to users, so users can assess quality, right? You're not just telling somebody, hey, this is good quality. You have to show them so that they can assess and make a determination. And I think that's the biggest challenge.
Right, and one of the things I believe that Crossref helped to develop was something called Crossmark. Mm-hmm. And that's also related to the whole notion of quality and trust, knowing that the content you're looking at is up to date. Tell us about that and sort of place that within that answer you just gave as to why that's important.
Well, one of the ideas behind Crossmark is for conveying extra information to readers about scholarly content, and so Crossmark is both a logo, but a user can that is is on content PDF HTML versions, and users can click on the logo, and it then gives them information about the current status of that article. So for scholarly content, if the content is corrected or even retracted or withdrawn, it's crucial that users know that information. So for instance, somebody may have downloaded a PDF, it's sitting on their hard drive for 6 months, the researcher goes to use it, wants to cite it, they may not know that content's changed. So the idea behind Crossmark is there can be extra information. They can click on that. It'll actually check the current status of that content and then tell the user, hey, wait a minute, something's changed about this. You need to, go look at the publisher-maintained version. And so that ties into this issue of trust, and that Crossmark is a sort of a platform for publishers to not only provide information about corrections, but information about peer review, what type of peer review that content underwent. And so it can, again, build trust. So we see that publishers could actually include a whole lot of information as part of the Crossmark, which could be rights information, copyright information. That can all it's sort of Crossmark is a vehicle for that information.
Right, and that point about trust is important because scholarly publishing, scientific publishing, at one point had a fairly limited audience. It was those who wrote the articles and those who read them. But because of the internet, because of Google, now that community has grown enormously. It's a global community. It includes absolutely anybody who can get to the internet and get to that particular article. So these questions of trust and reliability are all important, not just to the research community, but to this global audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And if somebody just does a Google search, there may be a scholarly journal article in there, but there may be other versions of that same article. There may be the author's version. There may be a version that's out of date, posted on a different website. So it can be very tricky to get users to understand this issue of quality and trust. But I think publishers. Publishers have to do that. They have to make an effort, but do it in such a way that, again, not just to say. My colleague Jeff Bilder always says, the worst way to get somebody to trust you is to say trust me, right? So you have to give people reasons why they should trust you, and so I think there's a whole range of activities that publishers need to do in order to gain that trust from end users, whether it be researchers or more lay readers, which is becoming more important, especially with open access and funders and governments concerned about public access to the outputs of research.
Right, and that puts the finger on something that really seems to me to be an important challenge when it comes to technology. So obviously we need to keep up with technology, but that then precipitates its own communications challenges, it seems to me, right? So they kind of go back and forth. We advance the technology, but then we really need to address the need to inform people about what's changed, how this is better for them. It really means you have to do the work sort of behind the scenes and then up front.
Yeah, and you have to hide the complexity, and there are a lot of challenges. And I think another big challenge is that we're in a world of imperfect information, I think everybody deals with this. And when you think about, say, the experience of Amazon, if in looking at Amazon recommendation system, and it can be good in some ways, but it can be just awful in some other ways. When you think about the computer power, that an organization like Amazon has, and the huge amounts of data that they have, when you look at the recommendations, I bought a birthday gift, for my 9-year-old a couple of years ago. And, for months and months after that, all my Amazon recommendations were things to do with 9-year-old children, that had nothing. They were totally useless to me after that one event. And I think that has an impact on scholarly publishing as well. And that's where we get to, say, identifying content, but also developing better services for users and collecting better information. And this is something we see all the time at Crossref. There's now publishers have new requirements for collecting lots of data in a reasonable way that they can distribute that they never did before. Things that have to come out of the editorial system, the manuscript tracking systems, information about funding, all this kind of stuff. And so the end goal is always to make things easier for the users, to establish that trust, to hide the complexity. So I think those are just some of the challenges that publishers are facing.
Well, Roy Kaufman, Ed was just hinting at something that comes up in almost all of these discussions, the secret word, if you will, and that's metadata, right? It is an important aspect of all of these points. And you've been involved working with Crossref and other organizations in helping develop standards around metadata. Can you talk to the challenge about that and just how, for this audience, they should view the development of standards? Is it, a positive development, driving change that's really a positive change? I know there are those who sort of worry that standards kind of lag behind change.
Yeah, so first of all, there are standards and standards. And what do I mean by that? There are standards like a DOI, where everyone would say, this is a standard, and it's got like an official standard stamp on it, and maybe it even comes from an official standard stamping organization like NISO or ISO or someone, and said, this is now the standard. Then there are the de facto standards that come up around normal human interaction. So I would say, Google search. No one's said, Google search is a standard. It just is what everyone uses, and frankly, there are better search engines out there, and probably Google could make a better search engine, but it probably chooses not to because something has now become the de facto standard. So, when we talk about sort of what's holding back, and Amazon's a really good example. I mean, the recommendations are a little bit flawed, and they don't always even know. I mean, they might know that someone who buys this book also buys this widget, and there's no connection between the book and the widget, but they've just noticed this pattern, and so they're just going to keep feeding up the pattern, and they don't even know. They see a pattern. They don't know what's behind it, and they really don't care. They just want to sell. But Amazon's a very closed system. So you have many, many publishers, and they want to be everything all at once for everyone. So they want to know that if you're buying What to Expect, you might also buy diapers or something very simple, but they have it all there. And the challenge for publishers, and where I think we need standards and we need communicate, it's not good enough, though, to have standards. You also have to adopt the standards, and then you have to not just adopt the standards, but then you have to use what you get out of the standard. So you get all this data back, as Ed was saying, publishers want data, everyone wants data. Then do they know what to do with the data when they get it? The ones who are, and the answer is probably yes to some degree, no to some degree, what are you going to do with it? The challenge with content and with STM is the long tail and the open systems, and everyone might have that little piece of data, But, you know, imagine you have a recommendation engine and you're, you know, you could be a very large publisher and say, you know, more like this. But the more like this is only coming from you because you don't have all the other publishers. And no matter how big you are, you could be, you know, the IEEE, you could be Elsevier, you could be Wiley. Your data set's only as big as your data set. And the real, you know, the users, they care a little bit about the brand, which is the journal name. If you're a society publisher, they also probably also care about the brand, you know, which is the society name. But they care about the brand, which is the author name. And ultimately, what they want is what answers their question. So, you know, even, you know, and then they'll evaluate the quality based on the brand. And the brand is the author, the publisher, the society, whatever. But first, they got to get the data. And, I mean, that's, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, Crossref and Crossref Search has done to some degree is to try to bring all of that together. But it's a whole lot of data, and then you got to mine all of that data, and you have to mine it intelligently. And so, you know, yes, we need standards. Yes, we need to develop standards where there's a gap. We need to adopt existing standards, even if they're de facto standards, and work together to expand them when there's that opportunity. But then we really have to share it and figure out what to do with it all. And that's where the opportunity is, but that's also where the challenge is.
Well, indeed. And Jerry, the other challenge that was important for the STM Future Labs was the rising role of the author. And this has come up sort of tangentially in the discussion so far. But I wonder if you could explore that point with us a little bit. I mean, this author, this researcher now, the contributor, is changed because they aren't simply providing content anymore. They're also a purchaser. They are fulfilling a transaction much more than simply submitting a manuscript. Talk about what that's going to mean for the future.
Right. So the concept that we came up with in December was the idea that the author now has the wallet. Right, the author, you know, more and more as we see open access taking hold, is the person with the money. So now we have a new dynamic in our interactions with the author, making it easy for that author across the industry to engage with us on a business level. I think is a challenge, and we talk about standards. I think, you know, standardizing, you know, that sort of interaction with the business, authors write not only for IEEE or the IET or Wiley or Elsevier, authors write for themselves. And in the process of doing that, they deal with many different companies. It would behoove us to try to standardize those interactions across the companies. I think that, you know, the other issue with authors is we coined this term at the Futures Lab called developing an author ecosystem. You know, it's not the ecosystem, right, but the ecosystem. And talk about standards. Eugene Garfield back, 40 years ago came up with the Journal Citation Index and using citations as a way of measuring not only a journal's value but an author's value. Now we're seeing this whole new area of altmetrics. Right, and there are so many new metrics out there now, and I think the challenge in the coming couple of years, and I think we behoove us to move pretty quickly on this, is to try to come to some common understanding of which alt metrics really matter. So downloads, right? Downloads may at first glance seem a no-brainer, but people could be downloading an article because it's really bad, or because it's a great example of plagiarism, right? Citations of citations. So who cites the papers that you cite, and doing some analysis on that. So I think combining the needs of the author, in linking that concept with standardization across the industry, I think is an area of opportunity for all of us to work together, in the coming 18 months, 2 years.
Right. Well, and the relationship with the author is changing, and not to hit on this note too often in this discussion, but really now that interaction between the publisher and the author resembles much more a B2C, if you will, right, business-to-consumer right relationship than it did in the past, and that's going to change the way you do business.
Exactly. That was all of my time in this business, the entity that we engaged with was the librarian or the dean of the library, held the wallet, and in that model it was a B2B transaction. Now it is moving towards B2C. We now need to cater to that author, not only on the side of making it easy for them to do business with us, but also things like editorial services in outside of the Western Hemisphere, providing service to those authors who want to get published in English speaking journals.
Tell me a bit more what you mean by editorial services in that context.
Well, the easy one is just copy editing. Helping them before the peer review process, shepherding their articles towards towards journals that fit their current level in their publishing career.
Right, but authors, here in London or back home in Boston or wherever they may be, they're going to be looking for additional services too, aren't they? They're going to be expecting more than simply that simple process of submission, peer review, acceptance.
Right. Well, the big one, obviously, right, is just rapid publication. I think that rapid publication, as well as getting feedback from the publishing community as to how well their article has been received, getting help from the publisher to promote that article. Publishers providing marketing services at that micro level now, where before we marketed at the journal level or the program level even. Now it's helping that author promote their own brand. And someone mentioned that I think Ed might have mentioned blogs. And one area that when we go to any university website and they generally are superstar scientists at different universities that might have a blog. And I think helping authors to, giving them a platform and an opportunity to blog about their area of expertise and promising that you'll shepherd that blog, curate that blog over time is another opportunity for all of us.
Fascinating. Well, Ed Pence, you were talking before about trust and the role of technology in all of this. It's about capturing the right information and being able to assess it, isn't it? And so, again, back to identifiers. Can you talk about just how well that's being done today? You've been with Crossref from day one. You were employee number one. In thinking about the future, every once in a while we have to stop and reflect on the past. How good a job has publishing done in those 14 years since you began working at Crossref in creating identifiers that do the job that's expected of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that I have a bias with having been at Crossref all that time, but I think the industry did a good thing with setting up Crossref. They came together and collaborated, different organizations, society publishers, nonprofit publishers, commercial publishers, got together and had a clear idea of what they wanted to do, and it was focused around services. It didn't just say, oh, we want to identify content. It was reference linking. Journals were going online, and publishers were signing bilateral linking agreements, trying to link with URLs. Things were breaking, and basically, there was this idea that we want to make reference linking more efficient, and so adopting the DOI system, solved that problem. And I think that's a real big issue with identifiers is not to just think, oh, well, we need identifiers, is to think about the problem you're trying to solve. And so I think that's been done There's still a lot to do, but we have 65 million DOIs now, journal articles, conference proceedings, book chapters, lots of stuff. So that's enabled us now to move on to other things. We've also, with ORCID, with the Open Researcher and Contributor ID, trying to do the same thing for authors. And the ORCID registry launched just over a year ago. And actually, just yesterday, the ORCID registry passed 500,000 researchers who've claimed an ID. So they're now uniquely identified, and that's going to become even more and more important, especially now within the global environment.
Right. Well, let's put that in perspective. I think I saw a number that there's something like 1.5 million researchers in the world. So you're doing pretty well if you've got half a million.
I've heard numbers higher than that. But yeah, if you look globally, it's millions of researchers. So it's a good start, and it links in with Crossref, it links in with services like Elsevier Scopus, you know. So it's going to help tie all this together. But what's interesting is that even though I think scholarly publishers, actually, unlike the music industry and the newspaper industry, made a successful transition, you know, kept business models intact, you know, big deals, all this kind of stuff. So journals are surprisingly unchanged in many ways, right? They're fully online and they're being successful. But even though that you've achieved that, you know, it just never stops. You know, there's the next wave, and so you just can't rest. You know, publishers keep having to innovate.
Well, right, and that seems to be the dilemma of technology, is just the pace of change, and also you raised it. There are often solutions that are developed for which there are no problems, and it seems to be a kind of a quandary for many people. The overwhelming volume of technology and applications, choosing which ones are appropriate for their business, knowing where to go, which direction to go, is really difficult.
Yeah, that's difficult. And getting back to the standards question, you know, what the good thing about standards is that there's so many to choose from. You know, I think there is a standards can be helpful, but standards can also definitely be misused. And often, I think people come up with a standard, and then try to fit it to a problem or something like that. Whereas I think what you know, the industry, the scholarly publishers can look to what happens on the internet, where there's much more of a bottom-up type standardization, that something doesn't get standardized till it's actually being used. You know, that presents its own problems. You know, once you're doing something a certain way, it's hard to change it. But I think for scholarly publishers, standards are important, but I think it has to be done carefully. And for instance, NISO in the U.S. has developed what they call recommended practices. So it's a way to very quickly agree, sort of on simple sort of best practices, without going all the way to say a formal standard. And then after something gets implemented, after it's being used, then you can look at actually creating a standard. Just an example of that is, say, the DOI system is an ISO standard now, but it had been up and running for almost 10 years before it became an ISO standard, whereas ISTC, the International Standard Text Code, I think was more created sort of as a standard in a more abstract way, rather than based on being used. And, you know, it's not really being, I don't really think it's being used much, you know, so that's just an example where they sort of created a standard, and now they're trying to sort of, there were particular problems it had to solve, but anyway, not to get into the weeds too much there.
Right. But we will talk more this afternoon about open access as a challenge for publishing specifically, but Crossref and NISO and others are working on a kind of standard for open access metadata. Can you talk about what are going to be the key ingredients for those standards? What are the things you're going to think about?
Yes, so I'm on the NISO open access metadata indicators group. I can't remember the acronym. So a bit of a mouthful. But so the basic idea there is very, very, very simple, was to try to look at a way to identify the status of an article. So one of the problems, use cases, is, you know, you've got hybrid journals, right? A journal where some of the articles are open access and some aren't, and how do you identify those? And so the group had some discussions. The draft recommendation is out for review right now. So check the NISO website. Comments are can be made until February 4th. And basically, we came up with a very, very practical solution. Two pieces of extra metadata that will help. One is a what we call a free-to-read tag. So a publisher could identify, and it can be dated, so it can be free to read for a period of time and then not free to read. So that's just a very simple indicator to say that anybody on the internet can get to that full text and read it. It doesn't say anything about any reuse rights or extra licensing, but it's just very clear thing. Search engines could use that to direct users to that. And then in addition, there's a tag called a license reference tag. So it's a link to a license, which then gives the user the ability to find out more information. So it may say free to read, and then there'd be a license, but the user can go and find out more about the status of that content. So it'd be interesting to see how that might tie in with things like the copyright hub. But it's a way for a publisher to make a statement and provide this extra information. And a key aspect is that if the license URI, the URL, is recognized, then that can be something that can be acted on. So if it's say, for instance, in a hybrid journal, if a journal article has a CC BY license, that's a statement by the publisher, hey, this, and then somebody, a machine reading that could actually then say, hey, this is open access. And it can be dated, so it may be the open access applies a year after publication for an embargo period, something like that. So with just a couple of pieces of metadata, we think it's a way to actually address a lot of the problems.
Right, and that seems really important, because one of the problems with open access is, what do you mean by open access?
And so
there you're helping to define that, to give an answer.
Right. And so we consciously said there's no way to define open access, because the definitions vary depending on who you are. But again, getting back to this issue of providing information to allow people to assess content, if there's a statement about the license, if there's a free-to-read tag, some of this other metadata, then an organization, say a research funder, can look at this data and say, does this meet my criteria for open access, right? And so that's the plan. People can use this information. So rather than trying to define what open access is, we're just saying, hey, here's a set of metadata. You know, you can make the decision for your own needs about it.
All right. Well, Roy Kaufman, in your work with Crossref and on the STM Copyright Committee and at Copyright Clearance Center, you're obviously addressing the needs of a variety of communities. I wonder if you can talk about the challenge of meeting the needs of such a varied group of people, and whether technology can help to address that.
Well, if technology can't help to address it, nothing will. So we'll start there with the easy answer. It's interesting. We're going from in STM and journals. I don't want to exclude humanities journals from that either. And maybe even now for open access books, you go from a world where you start with let's make it easy, and then you have to make it desirable. And I think that's a lot what Jerry was talking about with the sort of added services and promotion and things like that. I get involved a lot, both, when I was at Wiley and now at CCC, and, government and policy issues. And so you've got the copyright hub in the UK. Now the US is thinking, do we want a copyright hub, and what will it have? And it's so easy for me to say, well, in STM, we have DOIs, we have Crossref, we have all of these things. We have standards that are generally accepted. And the other thing about standards, it's great to have standards. It's great to choose amongst them. And then the other thing is to apply them in a standard way, which is the whole other problem. You'll all have the same standard. It's like using the same word meaning something completely the opposite. In the UK, if you table something, it means you're going to talk about it. In the US, if you table something, it means you're not going to talk about it. So you can use your standard a little bit in a funny way. But the further, music, which is not an industry, but many industries. If you think of it like from the licensing side, you've got performance rights, you've got sync rights, you've got all these things, which I'm not going to get into, but music is actually fairly far along. They have a lot of standards. I think their problem is they've got so many to choose from, they don't know which ones they want to use necessarily yet. Who is there anyone here in this room? I know there are people whose houses do trade publishing, but is there anyone who's purely a trade publisher in this room? Yeah, so start thinking, you know, start having the same kind of conversation with a trade publisher. It's very, very hard. They're not, they're still thinking of the book as a book, whereas in STM, you know, 5 years ago they were thinking of a book as a collection of chapters, and now they might be thinking of a book as a collection of chapters, figures, and words that correlate as a machine reads them in that way. The further you get from STM, but still within publishing, and we are all lumped together as publishers, the less adoption of standards you start to see, the further there is to go. Outside of publishing, there are some standards developing, for example, around images, you know, the PLOS registry. But I have to tell you, I go to one country, they're like, we love the PLOS registry, and then everyone in another country is like, yeah, no, we don't like the PLOS registry. So it's very hard. I do think that the journals business was kind of early to the game. They had Crossref. They've always been international. And for all the struggles we may have internally around standards and defining them and implementing new ones, we are generally pretty far ahead of almost every other content industry.
Well, when it comes, though, to addressing those needs of the communities, I guess what I hear you say there is that, yes, technology has to be the beginning of an answer, but there's still a role for what I'll call diplomacy. And this gets back to the point Ed raised about the communication challenge. Persuasion, gentle persuasion, is going to be important.
Yeah, well, you have to, you know, to have a standard work, you have to begin with the proposition that we're all in this together. And I think in STM, there's a long tradition of that. STM and humanities and journals, there's a long tradition of that. In a lot of other media and industries, there isn't a tradition of that at all. It's we're all after each other. And obviously, everyone competes within the journal space. You're competing for dollars. You're competing for authors. But there's at least a sort of thing where, you know, the pre-competitive part where you say, you know, this is good for all of us if we want to survive the next major disruption. And I often think of, you know, science publishing disrupted itself so many times in migrating online, and that's why it's been successful as a whole, getting where it is. But, you know, you have to have that subtle persuasion. And I actually think that's sort of the implicit in what Ed was talking about, this notion of, well, you start with something less than a standard. Because once you call something a standard, it's like calling it a law. All of a sudden, things that people would agree on, that people would adopt, all of a sudden the positions get, oh, we can't have this standard because that as a standard is scary. Whereas if you come up with something that's a little bit less than a standard, it becomes a de facto standard, people adopt it, and then you move into that. And that's, you know, and I think Ed's example is an excellent one. When you start from the ground up, and this is going to happen in all metrics as well, you know, you can't top down say, this is what you should look at. From now on, all faculty trying to get, you know, promoted to tenure, you should look at how many downloads of their article or how many blog posts there are about the article. It's going to have to come from the bottom up, and then the publishers are going to have to create a space to allow this to develop and then kind of recognize what it is when that time comes and then try to move it the next step.
Right.
It's not easy.
No, absolutely not. And Jerry Grinney, the point that Roy just raised for the trade publishing world, where they're still thinking about the book, the journal publishing world has moved beyond just thinking about the article, hasn't it? It's really now about publishing information, and that's itself a real technology challenge.
Yeah, I think there are great opportunities that lie before us that go beyond the article. One technology advance that occurred over the past 20 years is just the low cost of sensors, right? So this is now a data-intensive world because of the proliferation of sensors. We're collecting, as a civilization, so much more data. So we're seeing within the IEEE members coming to us and saying, hey, look at people at Verizon, for example. We're collecting data on the pathways of mobile telephone signals through, you know, skyscrapers in a metro area, and we have this 6 terabyte database on with this information, and we'd like to see someone curate that, or steward that, you know, for the future.
They went to you instead of the NSA for that?
Yeah, right. So I think that there's some great opportunities. You know, there are pharmaceutical companies that have been collecting lots of data over the past a couple of decades. So I think that there's much more of that, and people will begin to recognize that someone needs to begin to curate and steward that data. And I think it's a great opportunity for us to go out there. And I don't know how much money there is in that. I think the business model for that will be interesting. And maybe, we at least at the IEEE, we see ourselves in a sweet spot. I mean, that's our mission, is to further further the science of electrical and computer engineering. And so it's... the quandary that we're in an open access world, if our revenues drop, then it gets interesting in, how we fund these other services. But I think that overall there will be some great opportunities for us in the not-for-profit world as well as the for-profit world.
Right. Ed Pence, I think Crossref has a text and data mining initiative. Isn't that right?
Yeah. It's called Prospect. We ran a pilot last year, and it's just about sort of to roll out, and that sort of again, getting back to the machine, publishers needing to provide extra services, researchers being much more interested in different types of data. However, I would say that part of the issue with text and data mining is because I would argue that I would agree with Jerry that there's great opportunity, but I think publishers are a long way from taking advantage of it. I mean, PDF dominates, right? And PDF is like the horseless carriage, to the automobile, right? Although it serves its purpose, right? Researchers tend to like it, right? It serves its purpose. It's great. So I think it'd be interesting to see what the transition is to, I think there'll be increasing pressure, and maybe it's a generational thing, as science in some ways can change very slowly. But in some ways, the need for text to data mining is because when a researcher does their experiments, they do their research, it sort of gets distilled down into an article. It goes through the publisher process, and basically all this extra information, like say the data behind a graph or something like that, it's all stripped away, right? And it winds up in this PDF, and then the researchers want to text and data mine it to then get all this information sort of almost back out. So I think it'll be interesting to see over the next few years, if again, the challenge for publishers is collecting more of that information, having more of that information come through the publishing process, so that you may wind up with PDF, but there could be lots of metadata, extra metadata behind it. And certainly online publishers are doing it in their online formats with lots of semantic tagging and semantic indexing. And the challenge will be, do you do it post-publication or do you try to do it pre-publication? And there's, good and bad in each way, but I think a huge aspect is some of this has to come from the authors themselves, and they're really just getting their paper published, and asking them to do even more, I think, is a real challenge, especially when you're focused on the author as having the wallet. I think that's going to be a real challenge over the next few years about how kind of publishers manage that.
So. Right. Well, with that, we're going to close out this particular discussion. I want to thank our panelists, Jerry Grenier. He's the Senior Director of Publishing Technologies for the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, Ed Pence, Executive Director of Crossref, and my colleague, Roy Kaufman, Managing Director of New Ventures for Copyright Clearance Center. So thank you all on the panel, and thank you for your attention.